great evening, huh?
Thanks for coming to the show. Keep that swing thing happening, you know what I'm saying? Call it what you do.
Swing is back. Lindy Hop is back. I don't think there's a dance that is as expressive as Lindy Hop and gives you the chance to just express your joy to the music. You're holding this partner. There's nothing that feels like it. You can be wild. You can be crazy. You've got this partner in your arms. You put all the pieces together, and you have absolute magic when you dance.
Actually, how I got hooked up on it was I was out in Los Angeles at the Derby, and was just watching people dance, and I was like, oh, my God. I've seen my mom and dad dance like this all the time when I was growing up, and they were big jitterbuggers from the 40s and the 50s, and I just had to learn how to dance.
It's a wonderful way to experience and share some time with another person.
When you walk through the doors, there's really no generation gap. I mean, you see people that are 21 years old, and then you see people that are 91 years old, and they're all mixing together.
Actually, we started all this dancing business to look better at weddings.
It's big everywhere. I think there's something about it that is needed in the world right now. The social side of it, it's just the etiquette of it. Doing something together is really needed in our world.
Because, you know, it's the first contact dance since disco. There's been no contact dancing, like Billy Idol said in the 80s, dancing with myself. But swing is here, swing is contact, swing is sociable, swing is here to stay.
Swing that excites both dancers and musicians from coast to coast and around the world. It seems to be everywhere, all at once. But there's more to it than just nostalgia. It's a celebration of the history, tradition, and legacy of groundbreaking jazz legends and the power, energy, and sheer joy of hot new acts. It's a movement steeped in exhilaration and innovation, and like most forms of popular culture, it all comes down to the music.
What distinguishes swing, the concept of swing from other music, it's a very fine line. Arguably, among musicians, swing is really a feeling. Like, in other words, a swing breeds.
Swing music has a very visceral appeal. It just appeals on a gut level.
You know, it's very difficult to define swing. If you're talking musically, I would have to say that if you have to listen to a band like Count Basie's band, and you know what swing is when Basie is swinging, because your feet are stomping, your fingers popping, and your head to bobbing, you know? And anytime a band can make you do that, then they got to be swinging.
the big band and swing as being kind of synonymous with each other. When I think of swing, I think of Benny Goodman, and I think of Les Brown, and I think of Tommy Dorsey. I think it's a feel. It's a feel. And it's that sort of, it's like a team, you know, the camaraderie of this 18-piece band sitting up there and just swinging.
It's music of freedom. It's music of free expression, not only rhythmically and not only lyrically, but with scat singing, you know, melodically and impromptu. So I think it's a very American art form.
You see, big bands and swing music came out of Dixieland and small jazz bands.
New Orleans, the sweltering city in America's deep south, where as far back as the 1800s, a new musical form was taking root in the fertile soil of the Mississippi Delta. A strange combination of traditional African call and response figures blending with the more symphonic influences of European music. The result? A brand new musical language that many have come to call America's sole contribution to world culture, jazz.
And if you're going to discuss jazz, you must begin by listening to those who really created it. And it started with Louis Armstrong, or Louis. It really began with Louis Armstrong.
He was a great player. I heard recordings of Louis Armstrong that he made in the 20s, where he's playing high C's, which was considered hard and high at the time. You know, real swinging on one note.
He was the basis for jazz in this country. It came to him, heaven knows how. You know, he was a kid on the streets in New Orleans and pretty much learned to play by himself. Somebody showed him something, but very little. It must have been there, something he really can't account for. But it was there at a very tender age. And the trumpet was the focal point. He played the melody. He drove the band. The clarinet would weave a little pattern around it. The trombone was playing some jazz licks way down low. And here's the trumpet coming right smack through the middle. Without the trumpet, you wouldn't have had the melody.
During the early 20s, many jazz musicians moved to the urban centers of the North, and the best find themselves in the middle of the Harlem Renaissance, just in time for the birth of swing.
Lenox Avenue was really the avenue. This is where, and the 7th Avenue was should have been a street that should have been maintained as the main drag, because that was where the guys used to get dressed up and walk down. Everybody walked up and down 7th Avenue.
Oh, my 60-year friend. Noel Miller. Now, here's a young lady. When she started dancing, she knew that she was going to be a dancer. I mean, from the time she was growing up, Norm always felt that she was going to be a dancer. And she carried that right through Lindy Hopper.
Frankie Manning was the best Lindy Hopper ever. Best swinging dancer ever. And look good. See, the point is, swing has a certain look. Look at Frankie. That's how the dance is supposed to look.
Up until now, I mean, she's the grand lady of dance. I mean, she's a wonderful friend. She's, normally she's something else, man. Yeah, we've been friends since 1984, and we're still friends. I call her sometimes and say, "Hey, baby, how you doing?" She say, "Well, I woke up this morning." I said, "That's good, me too."
These houses are still up. See the fire escapes? Now, the fire escapes like with that in the back of your house. That's what we used to sit on the fire escape and sit there and watch the action going on in the ballroom. We couldn't see through the curtain, but you can see bodies moving, you know, like dancing bodies moving past. And Dot and I used to sit there. That was our entertainment.
Well, we used to go to BYPU, Baptist Young People Union, every Sunday afternoon. And like from my home to the church, there was this ballroom, like, in between those two places, you know. So one Sunday when we were passing by it, and we saw these kids out in front of this ballroom, we didn't actually know what was happening, but we found out, and that's when we, kind of started going dancing instead of going to church.
Now, see where this church is? That used to be a theater called the Odeon Theater. I did my first amateur contest there. I think I played every theater in Harlem.
Oh, there was like a ballroom on practically every corner in Harlem at that particular time.
Now, here was the Savoy two blocks down.
I usually like to say the Savoy Ballroom was a dancer's heaven, you know, like, when everybody say, well, when they die, I want to go to heaven, you know, like, well, I say, well, when I die, I want to go to Savoy, because that's my heaven, you know. The Savoy was a place for dancers, I mean, for people who want to dance and want to have a good time. Not that they necessarily wanted to be professional dancers, it was just that they went up there because they would have such a good time.
Okay, right here is where the Savoy was, right here. And you walked in there this way. See, now it took it that block to that block. The length of the Savoy Ballroom was a whole block long. See, you can judge from there, from this street here to that corner. That was the length of the ballroom. Over on this side, here was where the Lindy was created. Here's where all swing dancing began, right here. Right here in this ballroom. That we took it from here and spread it around the world.
There ain't no point in holding it down. I kick it a scratch and I'll have. Hey, hound dog, get out of my way. This cat's shaking on a hot tin roof.
I came in from Portchester on the New Haven Railroad, which stopped at 125th Street in Harlem. I caught the cab, and as we're driving by, I saw this big sign, Apollo Theater, and on the marquee, it said Cab Calloway and his rock friends. I was so totally knocked out. I love Cab, man. He used to have the coolest suits on. I mean, he used to have three wardrobe changes per show. He had 40 zoot suits or something, and he had matching shoes for every suit that he wore. Yeah, he was definitely a cool influence on me, you know, just because of his old fashioned side. Yeah.
First time I saw Cap Calloway, he came down a set of stairs with a black cape and the white top hat and the white tuxedo, and the girls came out and took the cape away. Well, I saw that, I knew I was hung for show business for the rest of my life. I never saw nothing like that. And I always told Cap, I said, you changed my whole life. I stayed in every show to watch him come down those stairs. It was nothing, because he was always the greatest showman in the world. And we saw them at this theater.
I'm here to bet you, it's gonna get you. It's soon will head you there. Oh, what a rhythm. It's the rhythm that you talk everything.
He had a tremendous stage presence. He knew how to strut on stage. His mannerisms were such that he just entertained from the minute he walked out. He was entertained. He knew how to dress. And then he had this way of shaking his hair that people like to see that. I thought it was silly.
Especially
but,
the girls.
Yeah.
King, the Harlem Performance Halls, the Apollo Theater has been the launching pad for scores of great artists. But more than that, it remains a focal point of the community.
The Apollo Theater has been just such a vital part of Harlem, of the growth of Harlem. This groove with Harlem. This street belongs, this is Harlem. When you see, this is the mecca of Harlem on 25th Street. And the Apollo Theater is the center of that.
There were many, many spirits on that stage, if I do say so myself. The spirit of like Ella Fitzgerald and Chick Webb and Billy Eckstein. You can just feel it when you're on that stage. And when I watch it on TV these days, I remember the moment that I walked up on that stage. And to me, it was the Carnegie Hall swing. You know, every major big band will have played that stage in that room.
The bands that played there were up-and-coming black bands that were going to be important in time. Were going to be heard by the white population. And were. Basie became just as popular with the white population of America as the black.
What I am attracted to within the swing era of big band swing is the sound of an artist like Count Basie. What he did with his music is he left spaces between the notes. That's the best way I can describe it, is Count Basie would always be for a dancer, that's fabulous, because we can create in the spaces, and it allows us to improvise and create new things. And there's nothing better than coming up with a step that you didn't think about, but suddenly taught itself to you.
It's 1927, and as Charles Lindbergh takes off to hop the Atlantic, back in Harlem, dancing is evolving at social events all over the neighborhood.
House rent party is you give a party, and people pay 25 cents to come in. That's how you pay your rent. And you serve pig feet and sauce and cold beer. I mean, house rent parties went over all over Harlem in those days because you had to. See, there's always a way of adding to your income. And so, but parties was where I started dancing.
To me, I think Herbert White was like a godfather to most of the kids at that particular time. He was like a bouncer at the Savoy Ballroom. And he would like go around the ballroom. And we knew that he was always looking for dancers. You might just be dancing out there, you know, and you see Herbert White walking down, and you started putting on something extra, you know, hoping he would say, hey, fella, you want a Johnny White, you know, Lindy Hoppers, you know. But actually, Whitey formed these dances. Shorty Snowden, Leroy Stretch Jones, and Freddie, they were like the first three big-time Lindy Hoppers to go into professional dancing. And I think Whitey kind of got the idea from them and said, oh yeah, if they can do it, so maybe I can get a group that can do it, you know?
I like Whitey. He wanted to lock up all the dances. He wanted, if you danced, you had to sort of, he didn't actually say it, but what you were saying, you either danced for him or you just didn't dance, especially around the Savoy Ballroom, and he had that kind of power. But that was good because it made you become part of a family of real good dancers, because the dancers we followed were the top. That was Shorty Snowden and Big B and Leroy Stretch. And these were extraordinary dancers, and we replaced them in the ballroom.
We used to go to circuses and things. We'd go to vaudeville outlets, and we used to see these acrobats doing stuff, and we would not just say, hey, man, you think we could do that? And so we'd go to all the circuses and try to see what the acrobats were doing, you know, to try to copy something from them and add it to the Lindy Hopping. So that's how we started making up, you know, more air steps and stuff like that.
So we came with the flat heel shoes that we could do these steps and things which the older girls couldn't. They wore dresses. We wore skirts out of high school, you know, high school attire. But because of our youth and being young and fresh-looking, you know, kids are, we got out here and started dancing. Well, the public adored us.
And when the first air step was originated and the first ensemble was created, then that made it the dance more of a performance type of thing. So when we started doing air steps and started doing ensemble dancing, then we started getting bookings in nightclubs, theaters, and, you know, things like that. We had got this contract, Whitey had got this contract for us to go to Hollywood to make the movie. And I had this idea. I said, well, what? I don't want to go out to Hollywood and, you know, just be dancing, you know, with nothing, you know, no kind of routine or anything like that. So I had said to Whitey, I said, well, look, Whitey, if we're going to make this movie, I say, I'm going to make up a routine. I say, even if we don't use it, at least when we get out there and they say, well, let me see what you can do, I mean, we will have something to show them. So I choreographed the ensemble that we're doing together. And we rehearsed that all the time, every single day, until the day we got ready to go to Hollywood. So we were right in sync with each other. We felt each other. I mean, I could tell my partner next to me, I could tell what they were feeling, what he was doing, you know, what beat he was gonna hit. So we just practiced and practiced and practiced till we all were on the same wavelength. We just could feel each other. And a lot of dancers now, most of them say to me, so, well, Frankie, did y'all really dance at that tempo? Did they speed it up? I say, no, we really danced at that tempo. We could actually execute each step that we did to that tempo. I mean, I couldn't do that now, but but then, yeah.
See the Helter Poppin' clip. It's the best Lindy Hop clip of all times. No other clip ever doesn't come up to that. And that's what I try to tell Frankie. Frankie said he did the routine. I said, Frankie, just look. The first and only time Lindy Hop has ever come out in the way it did, and nobody ever did that before. Nobody.
Atomic Fireballs got together, just me wanting to get a band together because all my friends had bands together, but I didn't really know what type of music to do.
Oh, income, income, not of a trick, save us from the man with the hands.
Well, the band's music takes the current music of today, which is rock and roll and alternative, mixes up with rhythm and blues from the 60s, being from Detroit, you know, the whole Motown thing, the Stax music from Memphis. Ray Charles, Louis Jordan, takes all those influences and brings it into the 90s. There's no guidelines to it. If you're like, it's not all about counting 1, 2, 3, rock step, 1, 2, rock step. It's just going for it, you know? Sweating, drinking, and just having a good time. And that's what, you know, I always thought about going out to a club or a bar was about.
You remind me of a man. Yeah, the man with the power.
Proud of, you know, I'm proud of what my ancestors have done, you know, and I'm quite fortunate that I've been able to learn about it and then continue to learn about it.
Negro has had a major influence on the total culture of America.
which of course, as I say, in American music is the greatest influence on the world. But I think the music situation today has reached a point where it isn't necessary for categories. I think that what people hear in music is either agreeable to the ear or not. And if this is so, if music is agreeable to my ear, why does it have to have a category? I don't see the reason. I mean, either it sounds good or it doesn't, you know.
Save us from the man with the hex.
Duke always brought something different. He brought a production. His whole band was involved with the show. Duke would open with a scrim down, and he'd be behind the scrim, and then you hear these trombones, boom, boom, up. Listen, Duke was just something else. There was no one like him.
Duke Ellington was a great composer, a gigantic showman, and he just created art music that will live forever.
The thing about Duke Ellington for me was that everything came as a surprise to the listener. Duke preferred to do something that hadn't been done before until right this moment, including the band. They rarely rehearsed. It's not known that Duke Ellington really, I could almost go out on a limb and say, ever rehearsed his band. The music, if he had some, he brought in tonight on tonight's job, wherever they happened to be. Could be a dance hall in West Virginia, but it was going to be on his terms. And the music would be usually brand new things he'd just written last night. You can't really call Ellington a swing band. It exists on its own terms. I just call it music. That's music, American music.
Ellington's band at that particular period in 41 was so far advanced harmonically than anything that was going on. It was the closest thing you could have to say would be classical, you know, avant-garde classical composers like Stravinsky and people of that ilk. To compare it, it was so far removed from what most jazz bands were doing.
He was extraordinary band leader. He was more than a band leader. He didn't even like you to be called, he wouldn't even be called a band leader. He thought he was the maestro. He lived the life like a maestro. He was like Stokowski. You know, only thing, he was playing jazz. That's all. He was so brilliant. He was just far above nobody. There was nobody like Duke. He was always far above everybody, ever. You know, he was just a tremendous talent. Had the same men 40, 50 years on the bandstand. I mean, that's incredible.
And I would say that he was more than just those things. He was an icon.
By 1935, swing was working its way into the white population, led by the most unlikely of band leaders.
Benny Goodman, a fabulous musician, in one respect especially, the clarinet. That's the only thing that mattered to Benny Goodman. Was the clarinet. He had one with him at all times. I don't think I ever saw him in the year I was with the band without a clarinet. And he played it accordingly. And nobody really came close in any field. In symphony orchestras, the players have to be very good, but they couldn't do what Benny did. His jazz playing was stupendous. And never anything but nearly perfect. And he knew that. He was very, very impatient with those around him who didn't match him in their ability. So people in the band caught hell.
He was could look at you over those glasses, and you knew that he was not pleased with something. Anyway, he would go around the bend and would pick out or pick on various players and give them the treatment.
There's a story how he used to go underneath the music stands of the sax section and listen to see if they're playing together. And you know, if you missed a note in his band, you were out of there.
Trumpet player will go blah, and it's heard. Clarinet player could miss a note and you can't be sure. And I think I told Benny that once. He looked at me, laughed, and turned and walked away.
Benny was definitely responsible for an awful lot of the music being popular. And he was smart, too, you know, in the sense that he recognized good music. He brought the arrangers. Benny began to realize he brought in all the great black arrangers. He brought in Fletcher Henderson. He got all these guys starting to write for his band.
Fletcher Henderson was a great arranger, a great innovator in the development of big bands. Unfortunately, he wasn't the greatest businessman or the strictest band leader, and so a lot of his groups didn't get the attention that it deserved.
For whatever the reasons, Fletcher's band failed eventually. He disbanded, let's put it that way.
At that point, he was hired by Benny Goodman to arrange tunes for his the radio show Let's Dance, and then eventually took Fletcher with him to the cross-country tour that eventually wound him up in here in Los Angeles.
In the mid-30s, Benny went on MCA, I think it was, sent Benny on a tour of the United States. Benny was playing at various venues clear across the country to lukewarm audiences. Everybody said, you know, it's nice, go home. And they thought no more about it. When he got, before they got to California, I think in Arizona or New Mexico, at some venue, Benny at one point turned to the Met bandsman and said, what do you say, fellas, let's call this quits. We're not getting anywhere with it. Right? But the feeling, the consensus was that they only had five more places to go and the tour was over. Let's do it and then we'll, you know, call it quits. And so they continued on until they got to a ballroom in Los Angeles and the kids went stark raving wild. There was no other way to describe it. They were just scraping the paint off the walls and walking on the ceiling. They couldn't get enough of this new music that Benny was playing.
It's the rhythm, rhythm, rhythm that gets them. The ha-cha-cha, the boogie-woogie, the vice versa, the nuts and bats. It's movement, movement, rhythm, rhythm, and all that.
And so Benny became the rage of right across the U.S. That style that he was playing was what we have come to call swing. And Benny was the first exploration of that style. Virtually every other great swing band that came after him copied that style. And I imagine that's why they called him King of Swing.
Goodman's astounding success ushers in the golden age of swing. Massive ballrooms and dance halls open up across the country as the masses take up jitterbugging, the new name for the Lindy Hop. Pandemonium reigns.
When we first came down to L.A., there was a big contest going on at the Hollywood Legion Stadium. And Raymond still wasn't my partner at that time. He came in a little bit later, darn it. But anyway, I entered that contest and was lucky enough to win it. And I won a Screen Actors Guild card on the strength of that, winning that contest.
Jean Bellows was one of those dancers that danced with Dean Collins and is a gorgeous dancer that is best remembered for her dancing in a film short called Groovy Movie.
Here, there, and everywhere, the stamping foot of the boogie piano player sets the tempo for nimble feet that dance the jitterbug. Winner of more than 100 rug-cutting contests is Arthur Walsh, top-flight hepcat.
Well, Arthur Walsh That was his baby. He was like the star of the Pete Smith specialty Groovy movie. And he asked me to be his partner. Now, that was, I was very thrilled with that.
Now, the basic step. It's easy to follow and goes like this. Girl left, white one. Boy right, black one. Girl white, black two. A boy black, white girl. Boy brown, brown. Oh, well, you see how it goes.
If you've seen the movie, we do sort of an instruction part in the beginning of it, kind of a tongue-in-cheek type of thing.
To be a hep cat, you got to practice plenty. You practice that shoulder stuff.
And then they speeded up the rhythm until we were flying off the floor at least a foot. But it was fun.
Short that they play called Groovy Movie, and there was this blonde, beautiful, unbelievable dancer on this short, and I was so drawn to her. I mean, the charisma that she exudes, and she's just such cutie.
And it's great to go out now and to find Jean dancing at the Derby and see that she has as much personality and as much love for the dance as she did that many years ago.
This is another of our idols. 6 years ago, it was Greg Hutchinson. I was at his house, and he showed me this clip. He said, "Man, wow, this is so great. I love the energy, the people were dancing in there, and the feeling, the groove, and the girl, she looked pretty and was dancing so good." I said, "Oh, man, this is a clip I like so much."
'41 was a benchmark year for big bands. Benny Goodman had his best band. Duke had one of his great bands. Basie, incredible. Lunsford, all kinds of great bands. '41.
Although the pre-war years see the pinnacle of swing's popularity, the emergence of Glenn Miller moves the sound even further away from its urban jazz beginnings.
For the second time in a generation, the youth of America is marching off to war. But this time to new and livelier rhythms, the new style of bandsmen like Captain Glenn Miller.
But when the war hit, they knew it wouldn't be a question of time and that they'll be called in, and that's how, and they called them in one after the other.
Every band needed players. And so, just like that, the next day I was on the road with the band. And I then continued that until I got drafted.
When I joined the Navy, I had to join as a trumpet player with another band, the band that was already there and established. And that lasted for about 18 months until I was shipped out.
Then, through the war years, with people going into the military and also the problem getting gas and transportation is a real problem for bands.
I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I couldn't go on doing what I was doing. It seemed too stupid. It seemed too irrelevant. And 2 weeks later, the band was gone, and I went down to the Navy and enlisted.
Bands were collapsing all over the country. Name bands. Bands that had been around for years. Bands like Artie Shaw, Cora Thornhill, all great bands. They all fell apart at that time.
When World War II ended, the average person going out for a weekend was still earning something like $20, $25 a week at that time. And just couldn't afford to pay $100 a night to see him, to dance to a band.
The band business had been taking a... and been slipping in popularity.
With the troops coming back, and people, we were just getting ready to enter the 50s, which was kind of where people were just, I just want to get back to normal.
But what really hurt the industry, the big band industry, was TV. People stayed home. And that was absolutely disastrous for big bands. And that was what, 1946, 1947, 1948? Doomsday for big bands in this country as we knew it. That was the end of the big band era in our country.
Well,
started for me, I was working at a Club Deluxe up on Haight Street, and I first saw the band Royal Crown Review from Los Angeles. I think they were probably the first swing band I had seen of the new swing scene. I think the thing that sets them apart is they're just such talented players, and their arrangements are so great. And Eddie Nichols, the front man, is just, you know, he's one of a kind.
Big kickoff after me messing around with some nightclubs kind of fell together as we go back to, like I said, this scene, whatever you call a scene, started up. There was more kids that were into this style starting to hang out, and then by luck we started to meet other guys that were into this thing. Hey, how do you like this idea? How do you like this idea?
The way me and Eddie actually met was through a tattoo artist named Mark Mahoney, who used to tattoo my dad. And he used to tell Eddie, I know this kid who can play. And Mark, tell me about Eddie. You know, I know this guy, man. He's a crazy cat. You guys should hook up. So eventually we did, man. And it just was like a great bond, man. We just knew we'd be playing music forever, no matter what, man.
We got together and jammed, and it was terrible. Mondo was good. We sucked, you know. And then it went from there. It just went from there. It started building blocks. Royal Crown Review, what I can say, one thing I can brag about my band is we've progressed from every record in style. We've all been learning and trying. It's not good enough for me to sound the way I did a year ago or do a show like I did a year ago, you know.
We're so influenced by the old American music, and our influences as far as decades range from the 20s all the way to till today, you know. But we still try to have a sound that's Royal Crown. We still try to do things that are fresh, write our own stuff. You know, there's seven of us in the band, and each guy has all his influences. And we all just throw them in a pot and see what we get.
We only felt knocked off a little bit for a while. Or I personally did when I saw some similarities. I mean, this is a style, and this stuff's all been done before, but not necessarily the way that my approach on it has been. So there was only a few sore points for me when I saw bands using, like, very close song styles or lyrics, you know. But after that, it's been a great experience because it's gotten a small part of the general public into American music again, which was one of our goals in the first place. So now I'm glad that there's so many bands doing it because kids are introduced to it now. We have 11-year-old kids coming to the show saying they want to hear a bebop number. I'm like, wow, that's really cool, you know? I dig that.
Leave the bottle of Thunderbird on the side. Here's just the next train. So everybody all aboard. It's the last call for the one slow-mo. All right. Thank you.
It was sort of a quiet little thing that was happening underground. Sort of like, I guess, how punk started or anything else. A lot of these people were old punk, ex-punk rockers. And what really struck me as interesting was you'd have these people dressed up in, you know, like they're from the 40s and have their hair sort of greased back, but you'd see their old tattoos on their arms saying, like, Black Flag or Social Distortion or, you know. So there was this weird juxtaposition of having this beautiful girl made up like a Varga girl with like a nose ring.
The interesting thing is that when we first started, needless to say, there wasn't a lot of swing bands. And one of the bands that was really renowned at the time was the Royal Crown Review. And so then they started playing at the club, and everybody, once they saw how people were dancing, they wanted to have swing lessons. So we started doing the swing lessons. We were one of the only people that did those. And then we got a CD from a band called Big Bad Voodoo Daddy that nobody had ever heard of. It was a band out of Ventura, and they were phenomenal.
Royal Crown Review was the band that started the Wednesday nights at the Derby 12 months before we had got there, and they built this great scene. And when they would go on the road or make a record or do something at that time, they would try to get substitution bands in there. So when they went to go make their record, we had a one-month trial.
Hey, Jack, I know what you're thinking. This now's as good as any juice I drink
at. And the first night we were in there, it was packed. And Tammy and Tony were like, wow, this is pretty good, you know, and they're pretty rough, but the crowd seems to really like it. And the next week it was bigger, and the next week it was bigger, and then it just sort of like, we just kind of took that night over, and it was really an incredible thing.
And it's you and me and the bottle next three tonight.
1996 proves to be a vital year for the swing revival with the release of the independent movie, Swingers.
Once the film came out, it just hit just at the right time. Sort of like with Saturday Night Fever with Disco, where it didn't start the trend, but it just was a small movie hitting at the right time to catch that wave.
We were just good friends. I didn't even know John was an actor or anything. I didn't even know he was a screenwriter or anything. And we just were hanging out. We were just friends. He called me up one day and he says, I got a screenplay for you to read, you know, and would you read it? And I'm like, yeah, it just seemed kind of fun. And I knew characters like that. And it was sort of what was going on in all of our lives anyhow. It seemed pretty, you know, much like he was taking what was happening at the time. And then one day we went into the Derby and it was a guerrilla shoot. There was no permits. There was nothing. We just went in and filmed a night there at the Derby. It was live, just like you saw. It was how it happened.
And they did a hell of a job performing it, and it just worked.